carry honor. So we have just been seeing how they treat each other, and this is how you live in harmony. This is the way harmony happens. And so then it goes on, and he says, I think, why don't I set aside my own ideas and just go along with these venerables' ideas? Yeah, this is a great way of living in harmony, not taking your own ideas too seriously, but letting go of your ideas when you feel it leads to problems, and just, okay, I can, you know, happy to just do whatever, it doesn't really matter so much. And I like this, one of these things that, you know, sometimes you hear this, that it's actually not the choice you make that is most important, but how you implement that choice is actually often more important than the choice that you make. And if you implement it well, then almost any choice can be successful. So sometimes we think that choice itself matters enormously, but actually in Buddhism, I think implementation is far more important than the actual choice. So you set your own things aside and you do what the other ones want. And that's what I do. Though we are different in body, sir, we are one in mind, as it were, or so it seems to me. So different in body, but working together in harmony, as if you are one in mind. It's kind of nice. All right. And the Venerables Nandiya and Kimbala spoke likewise, and they added, that's how we live in harmony, appreciating each other without quarreling, blending like milk and water, regarding each other with kindly eyes. Good, Anuruddha and friends, says the Buddha. But I hope you are living diligently, keen and resolute. So now we are kind of moving on a little bit. So first of all, are you living in harmony? That's the foundation. And once the foundation is in place, then, well, what about living diligently? What does this mean? And you will see here that there are three words down here that are diligent, keen, and resolute. You have apamatta, which is here rendered as diligent. And you have atapino, which is rendered as keen. And then pahitatta, which is resolute. So what do these words actually mean? And apamatta is the same as apamada, right? Apamada means something like heedful. Yeah, you know the word heedful. Yeah, heedful means like careful. It means circumspect. It means you think before you act. It means that you consider things properly. That's all the meanings of the idea of heedful in English. So for that reason, I think diligent to me misses the mark a little bit, because diligent means like you work really hard. Yeah, you're diligent with your work or whatever. But this is more about how you think. You use yoniso manasikara, you use wise attention, you use satisampajanya, clear comprehension or full awareness of what you're doing. Yeah, so you don't do things hastily, but you are considered in your approach to life and what you're doing. So this is like the wisdom aspect. You bring wisdom into your activities in your daily life. Then you have the second word here, atapi. And atapi is closely related to the ideas of vayama or padana, which is effort on the Buddhist path. So you make an effort. It is also a little bit related to the idea of energy, the energy of the mind. In other words, having that energy to do things. The word atapi actually comes from the idea of tapas. Tapas is like the idea of ascetic practices. So that's why sometimes atapi is translated as ardent, because ardent has to do with fire. It's a bit like ascetic practices. But ardent is a word that nobody uses these days. So nobody knows what it means. You have to have a dictionary to look it up. But it really means that you're putting forth an effort, or you are energetic in a certain way. Yeah. So you have wisdom, you have energy. And then pahitatta. Pahitatta is a similar kind of word. It means, it's the past participle that relates to the idea of making effort. So it means something like effortful or something like that. Here rendered as resolute. Yeah, so the ideas here are really effort and wisdom coming together is what kind of this really is about. So I would probably have rendered this something as heedful, keen and diligent, maybe something like that. Might be my preferred rendering of these things. So this is what this is about. Yeah, are you being wise? Are you putting forth effort? This is what the Buddha is asking about here. Huh? So this is on page 20, bottom of page 28. And then they reply, "Indeed, sir, we live heedfully," and etc., and all the other ones. How do you live in this way? Now this is interesting, right? So we now know that they are living in harmony. So how do you live diligently? How do you live heedfully? This is the answer. And this is probably also going to surprise you, the answer to this particular question. I assume you haven't read it yet. Maybe that is a wrong assumption. So what is the answer to this? And this is a kind of an answer you might not expect, right? So here, let's see what he has to say. "In this case, sir, whoever returns first from alms round prepares the seats and puts out the drinking water and the rubbish bin. If there's anything left over, whoever returns last eats it if they like. Otherwise, they throw it out where there is little greenery, or they drop it into water with little life, or no life, or no living creatures. Then they put away the seats, the drinking water, the rubbish bin, and they sweep the refectory, like the dining hall. If someone sees that the pot of water for washing, drinking, or the toilet is empty, they set it out. If he can't do it, he summons another with a wave of the hand, and they set it up by lifting it with their hands, but they don't break into speech for that reason. Every 5 days we sit together for the whole night and discuss the teachings. That is how we live heedful, keen and diligent." So this is the effort that they make. Yeah, we still haven't really got to the meditation part. We're still kind of dealing with the more basic things. How do you live wisely in your ordinary life? Basically, it is just a continuation of what we saw before, really. It is more about living in harmony and how to not just live in harmony, but living in harmony in a way that is conducive to peace. They don't really talk at all. There's no speech. Yeah, even if you have to do something together, you just wave people over with a hand by hand signal. And then you do it by, you know, and then that's kind of how they work together. And then every 5 days, you sit together the whole night and you discuss the teachings. Sabbadatting. I wonder whether it means the whole day, actually. I'm not sure if it means the whole day or the whole night. And anyway, it means something like that. So you have Dhamma discussions on a regular basis. And apart from those Dhamma discussions, you are quiet. And you just get on with your job. And you work together in harmony in this way. Ratti means night. It also means day. It means like a 24-hour period. If you say one day in English, often you mean like a 24-hour period. And the Pali word rat is used in the same way here. So it means both night and it also means 24-hour period. So maybe it means, it's hard to know exactly what it means here, but it may very well mean night, actually. So let's stick with night. So it doesn't really add maybe all that much to what we saw before, but it sort of gives you an idea how these monks are living together, yeah, a very kind of easy and peaceful lifestyle. So now we have laid a bit more of the foundations, and now comes the really interesting part, because now we come to the results of this kind of living, yeah. Now we have laid down the causes, the conditions that make results possible. These are the causes and conditions, this is what really matters. So what about the results? Now we get to the results. So Good, good, Anuruddha and friends. But as you live heedfully in this way, yeah, with keenness and also with diligence, have you achieved any superhuman distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones, a meditation at ease? So these are, now we're coming to the results of the path. Yeah, we have the superhuman, these are the Uttari Manusa Dhamma, and his superhuman insight or superhuman knowledge. He has here put it all together into one long phrase, but I prefer, have you achieved any superhuman qualities? And have you achieved a distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones? So what does a superhuman quality mean? What are these superhuman qualities? What does it mean even to be superhuman? What it means really is to go beyond the ordinary human world, the ordinary human experience. That's why it's called superhuman, because it is beyond ordinary human experience. What is ordinary human experience? It's the five senses. What is beyond the ordinary human experience? It's beyond the five senses. That's essentially what it is referring to here. So, what are these things? Well, they are four stages of awakening and the four jhanas. This is the superhuman qualities. And what is interesting about this is, and this is something that you see again and again in the suttas, is that the four stages of awakening are often lumped together with the four jhanas. Four jhanas and four stages of awakening are considered one group of qualities that are basically what the purpose of the monastic path, not the entire spiritual path, I should say, the purpose of the entire spiritual path. Four stages of awakening and the four jhanas together. And with the four stages of awakening, it's kind of obvious why they are the culmination of the path. But what about the four jhanas? They're also part of the path, right? But of course, they are the culmination of the path in the sense that they are with the path, the last part of the path. So you are very close to actually achieving the stages of awakening here. But it's very fascinating because it means that these jhana states are considered something very special in Buddhism. Yeah, they are on par with the stages of awakening in terms of their qualities, in terms of their otherworldliness, in terms of leaving the world behind, in terms of the joy and happiness that you get, all of these kind of things. They form a separate category. You are almost out of existence, almost out of this world when you get to these jhana states. And this is very important because very often we have these discussions and arguments about what are these jhana states. Yeah. I was just discussing with someone here the other day. He's going to remain nameless. No, I'm being naughty about the meaning of some of these things. Name and form, that's right. So the point is that because the jhanas are grouped together with the stages of awakening, it means that they are very profound things. And whenever someone says that the jhanas are easy to attain, and that they are fairly ordinary, that you can think and ponder while you're in the jhana, and you can kind of hear sounds and see things and all of these kind of things, it's very problematic because they are essentially at the very end of the Buddhist path. These are the results of the path. These are the things that we should look for. When you come to these jhana states, you have achieved what is called the footprint. You have come to the footstep of the Tathagata Pada. You know when you get to the jhanas, the Buddha must have been here because that's how profound they are. You can't really go to the end of the path without going through these qualities. So one of my principles for deciding what is a real jhana is that whoever speaks about the jhana in the most profound way is the one who is most likely to be correct. Because it is very unlikely that you can actually go beyond the jhana, that you can say something which is too profound. Because there isn't really much beyond the jhana, apart from the stages of awakening, right? So because there isn't much beyond, it means that the most profound person is likely to be correct about these things. So when you compare people describing jhana, if I were you, I would always go with the person who is most profound about these things. That is the most likely to be true. precisely because the way it is talked about, uttari manusadhamma, superhuman qualities, these are really extraordinary and exceptional. And the other qualification here, the other way it is described, as a distinction in knowledge and vision, worthy of the noble ones. Distinction in knowledge and vision, worthy of noble ones. And that's also very interesting. First, again, worthy of the noble ones. Now, the noble ones, of course, are the people who have attained the four stages of awakening. So again, we are in that category, of the stages of awakening. That's what the jhanas are, in that realm, seeing the same thing again. But what is interesting here is the idea of knowledge and vision, right? The jhanas are called knowledge and vision. That is not normally how you think about jhana. You see it down here, it's down here, jnana dasana. How can jhana be jnana dasana? And this is what is so interesting, that sometimes I think we misunderstand what these things actually are. We tend to think of jhana as a samatha or samadhi, something which has to do with calming of the mind. But the way it is described in the suttas, like here, it is actually a form of knowledge and vision. And the reason is because when you go enter into a state like this, a very profound state, the data, the understanding that you get by entering that state is actually very profound. And when you come out afterwards, you bring that understanding with you, and it alters your entire view of the world when you come out. And that's why these things are knowledge and visions, because coming out afterwards, you're no longer the same person. We talked yesterday about the idea of a positive trauma. So positive trauma, it means you're no longer the same person afterwards. So what you have seen, an alternative reality. You have seen for the first time what it means to leave behind the entire sensory world once and for all, entering a new existence. And because you have seen that, your understanding of the world is transformed. You understand that the entire sensory realm is not really interesting anymore. You have left it behind. You have found something more profound, something more meaningful, something deeper than you have ever experienced before in your life. The sensory realm no longer holds any interest to you after that. This is why it is knowledge and vision, because you have understood something about the nature of life, about the meaning of life itself. And this is also what you find in the Dhammapada, where the Buddha says that there is no jhana without wisdom, there's no wisdom without jhana. The one who has both is in the presence of Nibbana, Nibbana Santikeha. So in other words, wisdom and deep meditation go together. They are two sides of the same coin. You cannot really separate them. And this is this whole idea that Samatha and Vipassana always go together on the Buddhist path. There is no separate Samatha meditation and separate Vipassana meditation. There is only meditation, and that meditation brings with it two qualities, Samatha and Vipassana. The deeper the Samatha, the more Vipassana you have. The deeper the Vipassana, the more Samatha you have. This is a very deep Samatha, Samadhi, Jhana, so it brings with it also very deep Vipassana as part of it. They are, go together, they cannot be separated. It's a very important principle of Dhamma that you see everywhere. And so this whole idea that somehow Vipassana and Samatha should be separated as different meditation techniques, this is not how the Buddha taught. And I think it's important to realize that. So this is knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones. In other words, profound knowledge and vision. Not only that, but it is a distinction in knowledge and vision. Distinction means something special, something high, something unique, something, you get grades in school with the distinction because it is very profound and what you have done on that particular, you have done very well at school or whatever. So you can start to get the feeling here that we are talking about very profound qualities when the Buddha is talking about this. The four jhanas and the four stages of awakening is what he's talking about. And then the last thing here is a meditation at ease. Pasu viharo. And sometimes the jhanas are called the ditta dhamma sukha vihara, happy abidings in the present life. And here they are called pasu vihara. It literally means like a comfortable abiding, right? And this is one of the things I like about the word of the Buddha. It is often very understated. Yeah, Buddha doesn't overstate things. When the Buddha says a comfortable abiding, he means like really, really, really comfortable, right? It's not just chilling like this. That's not comfortable abiding here. This is like a really profound, comfortable abiding here. And these jhana states are such that, you know, you feel complete ease when you come out of them. And this is kind of why they are so beautiful. You can sit in one posture without moving for 2 days, when you come out, you feel utterly at ease when you come out afterwards. Yeah, there's no pains, there's no aches. If you try to sit, you know, still for 2 days without moving, you're going to feel terrible. You're going to have pains and aches everywhere. But if you do it via jhana, you feel more relaxed than ever before. And that's kind of the cool things about this. So it's a pasavihara in the highest sense of the word. You are really relaxed, really at ease, really chilled. And that's kind of the beauty of these particular states. So, have you achieved any of these things? Now we're coming really down to the nitty-gritty, yeah? So have they had any success? Okay, the foundations are in place. What are the results? Well, sir. Actually, let's stop there, because it's a nice place to stop. And let's do a few minutes of meditation, and then we'll come back to the next part in a second. Okay, so all right, any comments or questions, please? Does vision mean insight, is the question. Knowledge and vision is, I should maybe explain it a little bit. Knowledge and vision is the usual kind of words used in the suttas to mean insight, yes. One of the kind of classic expressions in the suttas is yata bhuta jnana dasana, which means to see things in accordance with reality. And you find this in a standard sequence called dependent liberation. You find this kind of sequence. And dependent liberation is one of the beautiful sequences in the suttas. And it starts off with sila, with morality, yeah, kindness. And because you live with sila, you have no regret. Abhipatisari, because you have no regret, you have pamudra, gladness. Because you have gladness, you have piti, rapture, yeah, that joy. From the piti, then you get pasadi, which is tranquility and calm. From tranquility comes bliss, sukha. From bliss comes samadhi, the stillness of the mind. And from samadhi comes yata bhuta nana dasana, knowledge and vision according to reality. This is meditation seen from the perspective of how it feels like personally. When you do meditation and it works, you go through that sequence of steps. Isn't that what it feels like? Bliss, more bliss, even more bliss. Peace, which is also bliss, even more bliss. Stillness, even more happy. You know, so it's bliss upon bliss upon bliss all the way. More and more bliss, and eventually you see things according to reality. So the Buddhist path is all about bliss and then an insight depending on bliss. It's a pretty good deal, right? Yeah. You almost explode. Almost, you know, you're almost unsure what's going to happen to you because so much bliss. Can I take all this bliss? That's one of those questions people have sometimes. So it is true. So please, yes.
Yeah, Ajahn, I think still regarding the jhana, it appears to me that jhana is very difficult to achieve. But there's one monk, American monk, that say it's not true. He said most of his people that attend his retreat, it is achieve one jhana.
Everyone achieves one jhana on retreat?
Yeah. He said, during his retreat, most people achieve jhana. I'm kind of skeptical about the comment. So, I think I'll comment on that.
Okay. The problem is that there is a lot of disagreement about the meaning of jhana in the world. There are lots of arguments. If you go on the internet, people are arguing, and some people call it some types of jhana called jhana light, other ones are called jhana, kind of the more serious jhana, whatever you want to call it. And so that's why it is important to have some kind of rules of thumb to decide what is the real jhana or not. Otherwise, we're actually going to be led astray about what it actually means. And this is what I've been trying to do here, kind of give a rule of thumb. It is very profound, yeah? And it is profound because it is always mentioned together with the four stages of awakening here. Jhana is called Sambodha Sukha, which means the happiness of awakening here. So the happiness in jhana is roughly equivalent to the happiness of awakening. Yeah, it's actually difficult to really take them apart. The difference is that awakening also has insight, but the happiness is of a similar kind. And so for that reason, when I hear the most profound explanation of jhana, I take that to be the real one, not the more shallow explanations. Because the consistency in the suttas of how profound it is, found everywhere in the suttas. So, for that reason, is it hard to... I don't know if hard is the right word. It is more like it takes a lot of dedication and commitment to achieve them. Because it's not hard. It's not like learning mathematics, you know. It's not kind of that kind of hard. It has more to do with having all the preparation in place. If the preparation is not there, you can't achieve it. It's not hard. It's impossible. But if the preparation is there, well, then you will achieve it. So it's just a matter of preparing the ground, and then it will happen automatically. So I think hard is maybe not quite the right word, but it does certainly take commitment and dedication to achieve them. Sometimes people complain. They say, well, you know, if jhanas are so profound, then nobody's going to get them, and, you know, we want to get them, so that's bad that they are so profound. But the point is not whether it is bad or not that people don't get them. The point is that you have to understand them in the right way. If you don't understand them in the right way, you cannot fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path. It's impossible. If you get the idea wrong of what a jhana is, you're never going to fulfill the path because you have the wrong ideas. And if you don't fulfill the path, you're not going to get the results of the path. So it matters enormously that we actually get these things right. Otherwise, we're destroying the possibility of practicing the path. But the beautiful thing about all of this is that there is enormous amounts of happiness and joy and stillness to be had before you get to the jhanas. I just mentioned the sequence of dependent liberation to the lady in front here. That you start off with sila. Pamudra is already gladness. Then you have piti, which is more joy. Then you have pasadi, which is more tranquility. Then you have bliss, which is even more tranquility. All of that, even before you get to the jhanas. It's like more bliss, even more bliss, even more peace. And it's just astonishing how much happiness there is to be had on this path when you start to look at it that way. So that makes the jhana even more kind of exciting, right? Because they are, after all of this bliss, there's even more bliss beyond, and that's kind of where the jhanas eventually are. So it's actually an extraordinarily interesting path, really, really exciting. And the amount of joy and meaning and happiness is almost unimaginable on this Buddhist path.
I'm going to hog the mic. Okay, Ajahn, this sentence in this sutta about the leftover.
Leftovers. Okay.
Say, otherwise, they throw it out where there is little that grows.
Yeah.
Or drop it into the water that has no living creatures.
Yeah.
My question is, why is that? Why do they throw it in these two places?
Yeah, that's a good question. Now that you mentioned it, I thought I knew the answer to that one. But maybe I don't. It's right here. Apaharite chadeti. Apaharite means where there's little greenery, quite literally. I think what it means, harite is often the word for crops, so it may mean where there are no crops. So you don't destroy the crops of someone. And where there is no apanake udake, why there should be no living creatures in the water? Maybe there's a danger that you will kill the living creatures. I don't know. It sounds like you're going to feed them. It doesn't sound like you're going to kill them. But maybe that's the idea that you. I think the general idea is that you don't want to destroy any life, whether it is crops or greenery or living. I think that's the idea. But exactly why that is happening, I'm not sure in this case. There must be some meaning behind this that I'm not quite aware of. So sorry to give such a disappointing answer, but yeah.
Because my idea is that when there's leftovers, we leave it to the little creatures to eat.
Yeah. And that is actually the correct way of thinking. That's a good point. And there is actually suttas that say that. So even it says that even if you have a little bit of leftover food in your alms bowl, if you pour it out with the intention, may the little creatures feed on this, you're making merit already. Yeah? It's kind of nice. I love those kind of ideas. So thank you for bringing that up. Because what it means, actually, it is quite easy to make merit sometimes. It's quite easy to make good karma. For good karma, all you have to do is change the state of mind that you have. Almost anything can be good karma. You know, I'm sitting here talking to you. I can just ramble on forever and talk randomly. Or I can have a good intention to say something which is helpful. And that difference makes the difference of whether I'm making good karma or not. So thanks for reminding me of that. I try to make better karma. But the same thing with you, every time, even if you ask a question, right? That question can come from a certain intention or not. Every time you have some food left over, and I have every day when I eat, I usually have a little bit of food left over, I can either just throw it out without thinking about it, or I can actually give it to some little creature like that. So as long as we can permeate our lives with this idea of good intentions, and every time we have good intentions, actually, then we are actually doing something positive for our own spiritual path, and helping other creatures at the same time. So, indeed. Good.
Ajahn. Oh, I'm here.
Over there, okay. Yeah.
Ajahn, just now you mentioned depending of liberation. Is it the same as Abhidbhujanga, the seven factors of enlightenment?
It is very, very closely connected to each other. So when you see the bhujangas, they also depend on each other. They also have a sequence. The first bhujanga leads to the second bhujanga. The second bhujanga leads to the third one. So they are actually connected causally. And the bhujangas are very similar because in the bhujangas you start with sati sambhujanga, the mindfulness awake. In fact, bhujanga is the factors of awakening, by the way, in case you don't know. So they have the mindfulness factor of awakening, which leads to the dhammavicaya sambhujanga, which is the factor of awakening of investigating qualities. And that leads to the energy sambhujanga, which is the virya sambhujanga, the factor of awakening of energy, which leads to the piti sambhujanga, the factor of awakening of rapture, which leads to the pasaddi sambhujanga, or the factor of awakening of tranquility, which leads to the samadhi sambhujanga, the factor of awakening of stillness, which leads to the upeka sambhujanga, factor of awakening of equanimity. Now, if you look at those factors, you will see in there, you see piti, rapture, you see tranquility, and you see samadhi, right? That is very similar, that sequence is very similar to the other dependent liberation sequence. If you put them next to each other, you can see the similarities. And that's what I sometimes do on retreat. I kind of put these things up next to each other to point it out. And then you can take the Anapanasati Sutta. Yeah, put that next to them as well. And that Anapanasati Sutta, which is the mindfulness of breathing sutta, also has very similar kind of qualities. It has piti, sukha, tranquility all in there. And you can see the parallel all the way across. So everything that has to do with meditation and the development of the mind, the sequences are roughly the same, but there are slight differences to show you the different ways in which the mind develops. Yeah, the kind of variations on the theme to give a broader view of what is happening here. So, yes.
Thank you, Ajahn.
Yeah. One over here. Okay, just a
I think Ajahn, you mentioned it's about the path is about really building up on the bliss and the bliss upon bliss and happiness upon happiness. I think speaking from personal experience, I think a lot of time when we reach a certain stillness in some meditation, then oftentimes I sabotage myself by saying I don't deserve this. This feels strange. I can only speak from my own experience. When the mind gets still, it feels kind of strange.
Yeah. Okay.
It's strange because it's not familiar.
Yeah.
I'm familiar with the thinking, the busyness, the whole thing. So it's a lot of time this self doubt and kind of, you know, I don't deserve this kind of feeling. Kind of just.
Okay.
There's always this block that says, although you say it's a good deal, but it's like I don't deserve a good deal, you know. That's just speaking from experience. How do we sort of you know, deal with such a issue?
Yeah. Okay, that's a good question. Yeah, that this is something that is happens sometimes. People have these kind of feelings that they don't deserve it or whatever. But you know, you deserve it. I'm just kind of so that's. It is not about this. This is where the sense of self gets in the way. Because it is the sense of self that says that. So really, you just have to understand that the mind is just a natural phenomenon. It is not about you or about anything at all. It is just about natural phenomena working. And you just get out of the way, you know. Don't interfere. It's not, there isn't any self anyway. You're kind of buying into the delusion of a self when you kind of have those ideas. And familiar, yeah.
I suppose what I tried to do, I don't know whether it's right, is just to say, hang on, I think the Buddha is right. So it's like putting a little bit of trust into the unknown a little bit, rather than trying to be logical about it.
Right.
And that kind of helps a little bit.
I'm not sure whether
a little bit of that kind of trust and just releasing that control But it's kind of hard without that faith element there.
Yeah,
to be honest.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. So that faith element is important, and you know that many people have been there before you because people attain these things all the time. You know, you hear about people attaining these things, so you know that they are there, both for lay people and for monastic. These things are available. So that confidence is well placed. And you read the suttas, you can probably recognize some of these things from the suttas as well. So a lot of it has to do with familiarity. And one of the things I would recommend every time you have such an experience, just to contemplate it, and start to see that how delightful it is, because it actually is very delightful. Just because you are not used to it doesn't mean that it is not worthwhile. In fact, it is enormously worthwhile. And once you start to get used to this kind of experience, they become like second nature. And it's like your ordinary experience that you can't get used to anymore. You kind of get feeling that actually my ordinary experience isn't all that interesting. So this twofold thing, this gradual giving up of the ordinary five sense experience and understanding the downside of that. The more you understand the downside of that, the more attractive these other experiences are going to seem, because then they contrast with the downside of those ones. And secondly, focus on, really contemplate the positive side of those experiences that seem strange. And as you do that, the mind will gradually kind of be attracted to them, and they will seem less and less strange. Familiarity will grow until eventually they are the reality. Everything else is the non-reality. This is normal. Everything else is abnormal. And then that's when you have really made it, right? And then you kind of go into those things. And get the self out of the way. The self is a problem. But what are we going to look at now? We're actually going to go into that theme right now with all of these upakilesas, the things that block meditation. This is kind of part of it. So let's have a look at this now and see where this gets us. All right. So the Buddha asked them, have you attained any of these superhuman qualities? Distinction and knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones, meditation at ease. And Venerable Anuruddha replies, well, sir, while meditating, heedful, keen, and diligent, we perceived both light and vision of forms. But before long, the light and the vision of forms vanish. We haven't worked out the reason for that. So what is this light and vision of forms? What are we talking about here? What is the result that they are getting from the practice? And light and vision of forms, as I think it's fairly clear, is basically the thing that in the present day we call samadhi nimitta. Samadhi nimitta is like a light in the mind, like the seeing of the moon or the sun or something like that in the mind. And this is light and form, because that samadhi nimitta, as we call it now, is basically a form and a light together. It's an appearance of a shape together with a light in the mind. And this is what this seems to mean, and there are some other pointers also in that direction. So in the suttas, the word samadhi nimitta does not mean what we now... It occurs, the word occurs in the suttas, but it doesn't mean what we now mean by the word samadhi nimitta. In the suttas, the word samadhi nimitta means the basis for samadhi, the foundation for samadhi, if you like, the object or the subject of meditation, which becomes the basis for samadhi. So, for example, in the sutta, they talk about the skeleton, and you can use a skeleton meditation to attain samadhi. That's the samadhi nimitta, because it is the sign or the basis, foundation for samadhi. So this is kind of interesting, right? The samadhi nimitta, you hear Ajahn Brahm talk about samadhi nimittas all the time, the bright light coming up in the mind. And that at this point, that's where meditation becomes extremely interesting, when these things start to happen. And it becomes incredibly powerful, and you get really excited, if you're not careful, when these things start to happen to you. So this is what we're all heading towards. This is where we are trying to achieve in many ways. This is the beginning of the experience of samadhi. So here we have these famous monks who are struggling with the kind of things that we are struggling with. Isn't that interesting here? These are exactly the kind of meditation that we are all trying to achieve. The samadhi nimittas, this peace of the mind in the same way. And as we have seen, the way to get to this point is very simple. Basically, you have to be kind. Basically, you have to live well, metta and compassion all around. And as you do that, this is the result we can expect, just like these monks are achieving this. But they are having a problem, just like we have a problem, they have a problem. Before long, the light and the vision vanish. What happened? Ajahn Brahm, please help me. It's all gone. I was so happy and I got excited and now it's gone and I want it again. Please give it, I want it back again. Ajahn Brahm will say, don't want it back, just enjoy what you have and it will come back or something like that. That's what he will tell you. And then they say, we haven't worked out the reason for this. Yeah. So now the Buddha is going to give them the reasons. So this is how we then find out how to sustain these deep meditations. Well, you should work out the reason for that, says the Buddha. Before my awakening, when I was still unawakened but intent on awakening, it's getting familiar now, every sutta we have this, because I specifically picked them out for that, I too perceived both light and vision of forms. So even the Buddha-to-be has actually been going down the same path, trying to figure out what is going on. But before long, my light and vision of forms vanished. Said Buddha, even the Buddha-to-be has exactly the same problem. And again, we might ask the question, exactly when did this happen? When on the path? And we can assume, I think, that the time under the Bodhi tree went on for quite a while, maybe a few weeks, while he actually learned to deal with all of these kind of defilements and things in the mind. It occurred to me, what's the cause? What's the reason why my light and vision of forms vanish? It occurred to me, doubt arose in me, and because of that, my immersion fell away. So here we can see, first of all, the word immersion. The word immersion here is samadhi. So we can now, from this, we can take it that sometimes the samadhi does not mean jhana in the sutta. Sometimes it means like a pre-jhana state. And here we have the idea, even if you have that light and the forms in the mind, it can be called a samadhi. It's not yet samma samadhi, not yet the full samadhi, but we are going in that direction. The mind is becoming very unified. But then there are all of these defilements, and one of these defilements, these upakilesas, is doubt. Doubt is arising. So what does it mean that doubt arises in meditation? This is kind of the interesting thing here. And the Pali word is vichikicca, is usually a word for doubt. It is the fifth of the five hindrances. The meaning of vichikicca, the way it is defined in the suttas, it is defined as being uncertain or having doubt about what are wholesome and unwholesome qualities. So you come to a certain point in your meditation, there is a blockage, you can't go any deeper than you already have. So why is it being blocked? And that is where you have doubt. You don't really understand what the blockage is in your meditation. And once you have that doubt, once that kind of the mind starts to think about that, or it starts to not really know what is going on, it doesn't know whether I should carry on watching the image, should I contemplate something, of course that is going to take you out of the meditation because you are uncertain about what is happening here. Because you start thinking about it, you start worrying about it, you start basically proliferating about something you should not proliferate about. So doubt will always lead the mind astray. You have to have confidence. Confidence that you are on the right path. And this is what Nirvan was saying before, the idea that you have to have confidence that you are on the right track. Otherwise the mind is going to withdraw from this. And so you abandon the doubt. You have confidence that you're doing the right thing. Why are you confident? Well, because these nimittas, these lights and forms, they are very pure. You can feel that the qualities are very good. You can feel the happiness and joy are there. The tranquility is there. Very beautiful qualities of mind. So they must be on the right track. Okay, let me put the doubt to one side. So you contemplate what is going on. You let go of that unpleasant or disturbing doubt. And then you can move on as a result of that. Don't allow the doubt to disturb you anymore. So when immersion falls away, the light and vision of forms vanish, because you lost your immersion because of doubt. I will make sure that doubt will not arise in me again. While meditating, diligent, keen, and resolute, I perceive both light and vision of form. So this is the first thing that the Buddha gives up, is the doubt, yeah? The last, if you like, of the five hindrances. And then he carries on, and again he perceives light and the vision of forms. But before long, my light and vision of forms vanished. It occurred to me, what's the cause, what's the reason why my light and vision of forms vanished? It occurred to me, loss of focus arose in me, and because of that, my immersion fell away. The Pali word is ammanasikaro. And manasikara means like attention, right? You are attending on something, and you're losing your attention on the object, losing the focus on the object, on the thing. And why is that happening? Well, sometimes it happens because you get distracted. Yeah, so let's say that there's a sound, for example, happening. At this point, you have not yet entered the jhana, so you still have the five senses are still there. Maybe there's a disturbing sound around you. Maybe you are meditating too close to the village. There's this beautiful sutta which talks about the Buddha seeing a monk meditating close to the village. And he says, I'm not happy with that monk. Even though he's sitting in samadhi really, kind of really well, he looks like the perfect monk. The Buddha says, not happy with that monk. And then the Buddha sees another monk in the forest. And this monk in the forest is kind of nodding away, yeah? Really tired. And the Buddha says, that's my monk. It's astonishing when you see that, because you think that's exactly what the Buddha would not say. You think the Buddha would say, well, as long as you get samadhi, you are okay, right? The nodding monk, forget about the nodding monk, the samadhi one is good. But actually, he says the opposite. And it's a very interesting thing, because what it shows you, that actually putting in the causes is more important than the results. If you put in the right causes, in the long run, you're going to have good results. So being secluded is really the critical thing that will ensure that you can sustain the samadhi in the long run. And this kind of amanasikara may very well happen precisely because you're sitting in the village. A noise happens, or maybe suddenly you start thinking about something, right? Your mind can, oh, I have to, what about lunch, right? I'm a monk, if I don't get lunch now, yeah, I will miss my lunch, oh, help. For monks, lunch is really important, right? That's one meal of the day. If you don't get that, you are kind of... actually, here we have a very nice breakfast. Here, the breakfast is really cool, so we can't really complain here. But if you have one meal a day, actually, one meal a day, if you don't get it, it actually is important, right? You can see why that is the case. So, amanasikara, or anything else that is distracting, you lose your attention. That is really what it means here, by losing focus. So you have to make sure you stick with what you're doing. Yeah. When immersion falls away, the light and vision of forms vanish. I will make sure that neither doubt nor loss of focus will arise in me. While meditating, dullness and drowsiness arose in me. So you can see here that we are looking at the five hindrances. So first of all, almost like in reverse order, not quite. So we had the doubt, and we had the loss of attention, which is maybe a little bit like restlessness. Yeah, the mind wanders a little bit. And now we have dullness and drowsiness. And what we are talking about here is a very small amount of dullness and drowsiness. You may not even understand it as dullness and drowsiness. But the mind loses some of its brightness. Yeah, for whatever reason, maybe it is a physical thing that you have eaten too much and suddenly kind of kicks in, or maybe that your energy reserve is used up for whatever reason, and something happens within your mind and body that then allows the dullness and drowsiness to come. Usually, you don't get dull and drowsy when you have these kind of qualities, because they are the opposite of dullness and drowsiness. But because the mind and body is so complex, it can happen. And what it feels like in this case, it's like the light of the mind becomes more dim. You lose the brightness in the mind, yeah? That's why the light kind of dims down and eventually disappears altogether. That is a sign of dullness in the mind. The more bright the light is, the less dullness there is, because the brightness, powerful energy in the mind is the exact opposite of the dullness. And you feel really, really awake at these particular points. So you have to avoid the dullness and drownness. How do you avoid that? Well, basically by staying with the light in the mind, yeah? By focusing on it, enjoying that kind of thing in the mind. That's how you kind of avoid these things to happen there. So you avoid the doubt by not giving in to doubt, but by having confidence in the object. You avoid the non-attention by staying with the object. And here is a similar kind of thing. You stay with the brightness of the object. I'll make sure that neither doubt, nor loss of focus, nor dullness and drowsiness will arise in me again. While meditating, terror, or fear might be the better translation, arose in me, and because of that, my immersion fell away. So you become fearful. Why would you become fearful when you have so much bliss and happiness? And the reason you become fearful is because you are entering very unknown territory. Yeah, this was like Nirvan was saying before. This is unusual. This is something really weird going on here. I'm not used to this. And of course, very easily, then you can feel that you're kind of losing yourself. What happened to my old self? I could think, I could do all of these kind of things. Now that self is kind of disappearing a bit. And the deeper the meditation goes, the more it feels like your self is disappearing. All the ordinary signs of you, like the thinking mind, the mind which is able to will this and will that, the mind, you know, the feelings of the body, the awareness of the five senses, all of that is fading away. You are entering into a very strange territory where you have never been before. Even though it is extremely pleasant, it's extremely happy, it is extremely still and peaceful, because it is unusual, you feel a bit scared. And the deeper you go, yeah, you can kind of feel that you're losing yourself even more. And what if you can't get them back again? Right? What if you're giving up the sense of self for good? That's kind of really frightening. What about these senses? The moment you enter a jhana state, it's like you're giving up the senses once and for all, because you have to give them up completely to enter the jhana state. And because you have to give them up completely, it is like maybe they never come back again. Are you willing to give up the sense of sight once and for all? You can never hear anything again in the rest of your life. That is kind of the thing you have to do on the doorway to jhana, and that is why it can feel like a challenge to enter, yeah, because you're leaving something behind. But what you're leaving behind is actually rubbish. So leave behind the rubbish, right? And enter something which is the opposite of rubbish. The gold, the diamond of the mind, yeah, that kind of emerges out of this as you do this. And so this is kind of the point. And one of the things that we also are letting go of at this particular point, which is very scary, or it's not actually scary, but we think it's scary, and that is the ability to will, the ability to intend things. You can no longer will anything. You're leaving behind the doer, which does things. And the doer is a very important part of who we take ourselves to be. Yeah, we are the doers in the world. We are the creators. We are the people who get things happening. Creativity is a very important part of human existence. So leaving that behind is also kind of, can feel scary, even though it actually isn't scary at all, even though it is the happiest thing you've ever done. It looks, from this side of things, it can seem like it is frightening. So you have to learn how to deal with these things. You have to learn why they are really happy. And eventually, as you learn that, you understand that this actually is very useful, then you give it up, and then you can enter these very powerful and life-transforming states as a consequence. Don't think that this is only for very advanced meditators. This is also for all of us, because all of us, we have these kind of issues. We have them maybe slightly more coarsely than what we're talking about here, but the same issues are there for everyone, regardless of if you are a beginner or you are more an advanced meditator. Yeah, sometimes you can feel a bit of fear. Where is this leading? Yeah. Certainly dullness and drowsiness. Yeah, most people know what that feels like in meditation. And that's kind of part of the thing we have to learn to deal with. So don't think that this is not relevant to you. It is relevant, because these things come in both coarse and refined manifestations. When immersion falls away, the light and the vision of forms vanish. Suppose a person was traveling along a road and killers were to spring out at them from both sides. they will feel terrified because of that. In the same way, terror arose in me here. That's kind of an interesting simile, isn't it? The killers emerge from both sides of the road. That is what meditation is like. Yeah? Are you sure you want to carry on with meditation? So the idea, this is kind of an extraordinary simile, but the idea here, yeah, this is what exactly what I was saying before, is that when you go deep in meditation, it feels like part of you has to be left behind. Part of you has to die almost, right? It's like the killer comes for that part of you and you leave it behind. But it's actually not really a killer, because what is happening, of course, is that even though you leave it behind, once you come out of that samadhi, you come back again. Yeah, you get back all of those things. And then when you come back, you think, oh no, I don't want them back anymore now. Yeah, finally got rid of that nonsense. Yeah, but now I have to take it back again. So suddenly your perspective is completely changed. Beforehand you are afraid of it, afterwards you don't want it back again at all. That's kind of the interesting thing here. But it feels like a very important part of you has to be left behind. That's why the idea of killers, I think, is used here in the simile. Yeah. I will make sure that neither doubt, nor loss of focus, nor dullness and drowsiness, nor terror will arise in me. While meditating, excitement arose in me, and because of that, my immersion fell away. A very common experience for people who have some deep meditation, yeah? I hear about these things all the time. You have one kind of really powerful experience, and then you get close, and you get really, really excited. Yes, it's happening. And the moment you think that, destroyed, yeah? There's no way it's going to happen anymore, because you've gone way over the top there. So this is the excitement. And after a while, you learn that actually it's all about cause and effect. It all just happens naturally anyway. It's got nothing to do with it. There's nothing to be excited about. It's just nature taking its course. You just relax. If it happens, it happens. If it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. It's fine with me, because I don't exist anyway. Or something like that. Yeah, you just kind of stay with it. You enjoy what is there. You learn how to relax with whatever happens, and you're happy with whatever happens. You know that these things are out of control. Whether you get excited or not, actually, that's got nothing to do with it. When nature is ready, these states will happen on their own. So you learn to go with the flow of things. You learn to just relax, sit back, and enjoy what is happening here. But excitement can be a problem. Learn to see these things as nature taking its course, and then you are on the right track. When immersion falls away, the light and vision of forms vanish. Suppose a person was looking for the entrance to a hidden treasure. Yeah, this is what we're looking for here. We're looking for a treasure, because these things are the highest treasures that human beings can experience, quite literally, in samadhi. So this is really what it is about, looking for gold, if you like. And all at once, they would come across five entrances. They would feel excited because of that. Yeah, you have this excitement because suddenly you see the entrance to the samadhi here, the entrance, entryway here. Why is there five entrances? Five senses? Yeah, I'm not sure if the senses are called an entrance to samadhi though. I think that's that might be stretching the idea of the senses a little bit. It is a good question why there is five, and it could be that it is the five jhanas. Usually only four jhanas, but sometimes there is five. So maybe there's kind of five possibilities, and you enter the each jhana has a separate entrance. I'm not sure. Maybe the commentary has an answer to that one. I'll look it up later on and let you know what the commentary says then. In the same way, excitement arose in me here. I'll make sure that neither doubt, nor loss of focus, nor dullness and drowsiness, nor terror, nor excitement will arise in me again. So you learn how to deal with each one of these defilements in turn. And then you go carry on. And while meditating, discomfort arose in me here. discomfort. Sometimes called inertia, which is a slightly strange word. I prefer discomfort, I think. I think this is a nice translation by Bhante Sujato here. I shouldn't always criticize him. I should praise him as well. That's well done, Bhante Sujato. Make sure that neither doubt, nor loss of focus, nor dullness and drowsiness, nor terror, nor excitement, nor discomfort will arise in me again. So, again, discomfort can arise because the senses are still operative at this point. What happens at this point in your meditation is that the senses are starting to fade away very powerfully. They're kind of in the background, but they haven't completely disappeared yet. And this is why, even at this place, we are still usually doing anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing. The breath is kind of there in the background, functioning like an anchor to what you're doing. The prominent feeling, the prominent thing is the nimitta, the sign, the light and the form in your mind. That is the prominent thing that is there. But the mind, the breath is like in the background, like an anchor which is there that you can turn to if necessary. When it fades away or whatever, you can go back to the breath again, or the breath is there. But of course, as long as the body is there, there is also the potential for discomfort in the body. This kind of discomfort could also be a sound that penetrates the meditation. The last thing you want to hear is sound at this point. So if some loud person comes around saying, "Hey, where are you?" You will hear that like like somewhere really far away. You hear this sound really, really far away, even if they're very close to you, because it's like you have moved away from this whole five-sense world. You're in a way into a different reality, and it feels like all of these things are kind of disappearing. But they can penetrate your shield of samadhi a little bit, and that can be uncomfortable. And that is what you're seeing at this particular point. So you learn to stay in seclusion. You learn to go away from people. You learn to not pay attention to the body. Come back to the breath. Focus back on the nimitta. And then you allow this duttulang, this discomfort, to cease and disappear as a consequence. Okay, let's take another short meditation break. Okay. So, please, if you wish to bring up anything, now please do so.
Ajahn. When I first saw the list, I was thinking that this is going to be Panchan Nivarana, but seems like the list of obstructions is endless. And is this sutta providing the definitive and complete list of obstructions, or will it be different for each and everyone?
I don't think there is a definitive list of obstructions. I don't think that such a list exists. I think you can always subdivide more and you can come up with new things. But I think the five hindrances is really the definitive list. And you can take it that all of these things that you see here are somehow included within the five hindrances. This is more like a finer division. Like discomfort probably is a kind of restlessness, right? And all of them can really somehow be included within those five hindrances in one way or another. So I would argue the five hindrances are the final kind of listing, but this is just an alternative viewpoint on those five hindrances. And that's why it's useful to know that actually there isn't any final thing. It's just how each one of us looks at it slightly differently, as you say, which I think is right, basically.
Thank you, Ajahn.
Yeah. Please, yeah. Yes. If you don't have any questions, I will just drink coffee. So I please.
Yeah, Ajahn. You give a very good point. That is, putting in the causes is more important, right? So I see here the Vatupama Sutta is a very good one of the Upakilesas.
Yeah.
Because it got about 16 Upakilesas there.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if we can remove that from ourselves, then it would be very, very good. So how to do that?
How to do that? It's interesting. I think the main way to do that is just to practice the Noble Eightfold Path, you know. And if you always contemplate how can I live with kindness and live morally and not do bad things toward others, actually those defilements will disappear automatically. It will just be part of that process of living well. Sometimes you may have some very strong defilements that are blocking you. You know, some people can be very arrogant, or some people can be very dominating, or they can be very, have some very powerful defilements. And for them, it might be useful to look at that list and see, okay, maybe I have a problem in these areas. And then you have to be very honest with yourself that actually I have a problem here. I need to deal with this. But I think for most people, it's probably enough just to practice the Noble Eightfold Path and do all of those things, and I think that will undermine those defilements, generally speaking. Yeah. So I would. That's basically what I would tend to argue myself. Yeah.
Sukiyoto Ajahn. Ajahn, can I get your opinion? So I heard that. Somebody said that the jhanas are related to the chakra points. It's like opening of the chakra points. And also, do you think it has something to do with the pineal gland?
What has to do with the pineal gland?
The jhanas.
Jhanas, pineal gland, okay.
Thank you.
Starting to mix different religions together, you know. Because chakras is all about Hinduism and kind of the Vedanta and that kind of tradition. And then we are kind of saying that we're trying to kind of point to similarities between the Hindu tradition and the Buddhist tradition. And is there similarities? Maybe there is, maybe there isn't. But I think that you don't really need to kind of go, you know, I'm happy with what the, I'm not sure if it is very helpful to think of it in terms of chakras. I'm not sure if it actually adds anything to the path. And I would just stay I prefer always to say with the word of the Buddha, because to me that is the final kind of answer to these things, and not to kind of bring in too many external things. It may not be wrong. Maybe it will work for some. Maybe it can give you some good ideas on how to make meditation work. But generally speaking, I would just stay with what the suttas have to say. The pineal gland, I have no idea. The pineal gland is a physical thing, but these are purely mental experiences. So whether there is a correlation or not, maybe there is, maybe there isn't. I just no idea, to be honest with you. Anyway, yeah. Yes, please, sir.
Yeah, elaborate a little on the perceive light and vision of forms.
Uh-huh.
What does vision mean? Is it something imaginary? Is it something that you see something in future?
Is it imaginary? No, not really, because what it is, it's almost like as you do this kind of practice, it's almost like the breath transforming almost. There comes a point when there's like almost like a mental image of the breath or something like that actually is happening there. So the light is just a natural phenomenon of the mind. This is what happens when the mind becomes peaceful and happy. You actually get these kind of visions. So it's not really imaginary, because I think everyone has, you're not actually making them happen. They happen by themselves, whether you want to or not. And it seems to be pretty universal that people have these experiences. But they can vary a little bit depending on your personality, and I think that is an important point. The colors can be a bit different, the shapes can be a bit different, and there may even be some people who cannot actually have this kind of visual nimittas. It's possible, but generally speaking, I think people will have them. So there is a degree to which they are conditioned by personality, but the general idea seems to be universal that people have these things. So all you have to do is just wait. Relax, watch the breath, and allow it to happen. It will happen by itself. No need to imagine anything. No need to do anything. Yeah. It's an automatic process. That's the main point. Please.
Actually, this is the first time I'm attending this meditation course. I don't know much about meditation anything.
Okay.
But yeah. I think this course is very beneficial for me. I don't know. Because yesterday, when I was doing meditation, I could feel, I could see clouds of light.
Really? Okay.
Silver light coming out from my body.
Cool. Right? Yeah. Excellent.
And then just now, this morning, I did one. The one, the 45 minutes is very good.
Yeah.
I could see form.
Yeah.
Form
okay.
Vision. I saw houses, golden, yellow houses, rose or red houses.
Okay.
But they don't last long. Only 1 or 2 seconds.
Okay. Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Badly built house.
That's what I experienced. Yeah. And this is my first time. You know.
Yeah.
To know that it happens.
Okay, cool.
If I tell others, they think that I'm going crazy, but I know.
No, that's wonderful. I'm very happy to hear that, actually. That's great, yeah.
Okay.
So one other thing so really, when you see a house, it's a very complicated form. So you want
rows of houses.
Even more complicated. So you want to make it as simple as possible.
Okay.
So that's only the beginning. Yeah, but good, well done. Yeah.
Light easy to see.
Yeah,
the
okay.
House, the forms are a bit difficult.
Okay.
All the time.
Okay.
But next time I meditate, do we have to sit down on like a Buddha?
You can do whatever you like. You can sit on a chair. You can sit down like a Buddha. You can sit down like anything. Whatever you want to do.
Okay.
Yeah. There's only one posture we don't recommend. That is standing on your head. Don't stand on your head.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Very good. Okay. That's wonderful. I'm very happy that you're getting some nice results. That's really, really marvelous, actually, because that's the purpose of this path. And so that's actually a wonderful, wonderful thing. So well done. And also the beginner as well. That's really, really nice, isn't it? So let's have another break, everyone. Have a nice cup of tea or whatever, and we'll see you back in half an hour again.